Hello and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Lori Flores, author of Grounds for Dreaming, Mexican Americans, Mexican Immigrants, and the California Farmworker Movement, published by Yale University Press in 2015. Dr. Flores is an assistant professor of history at Stony Brook University, where she teaches classes in U.S., Latino, labor, immigration, and borderlands history. Her research and writing focuses on Mexican-American life, labor, and politics in the post-World War II period. She is particularly interested in the working and social relationships between Mexican-Americans and Mexican migrants. Hello, Lori, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Hi, how's it going?
Wonderful. I'm going to add that Lori and I are sitting on a nice little balcony at UC Santa Barbara.
It's beautiful.
Attending the third biannual Sal Castro Memorial Chicano Studies Conference.
Yes,
at
here
UC
at
Santa
UC
Barbara.
Santa Barbara. It's, you know, classes are in session. Students are moving back and forth. We're here by a lake. I can see the ocean a little bit. It's gorgeous.
It is a
sunshine.
Beautiful day. We're going to try not to get too distracted with this gorgeous weather and make our listeners jealous who may be on other parts with less country.
Sorry,
with
guys.
Less pleasing weather. But so, Lori, so glad you're with us here on the channel. Why don't you start by telling us a little bit about yourself, about your background?
Well, I grew up in South Texas, a little town called Alice, which is sort of near the Corpus Christi area, and didn't really leave Texas for all of my childhood until I went to college at Yale. So Yale was a bit of a culture shock to me, but it was, you know, one of the best decisions I ever made in my life because I made, you know, good friends, first of all, and got a great education, but that's where I sort of fell in love with Latino history because I took a Mexican American history survey course with Stephen Pitti, mm-hmm. who's still there at Yale.
Right.
And I just really was blown away by this class and this realization I had as like a 19-year-old that I could make a career out of reading and writing about, you know, Mexican American history. And
exactly.
So
exactly. Mind blowing, right?
Yeah, it totally blew my mind. And so I asked Steve to be my advisor. He said yes. And always treated me like a future colleague. Like, I think he always sort of had this faith that I would go on to graduate school, which I did. So I went on to Stanford and studied under Al Camarillo and got my PhD there in 2011. And this book, Grounds for Dreaming, is an outgrowth of the dissertation I worked on there. So it was while I was at Stanford that I got interested in the Salinas Valley.
Right. You know, I'm particularly interested in the title.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine it may have taken you, if you're like me, forever to finally settle on this. But
I have a really funny story.
It's just
that.
So grabby. Yeah, why don't you tell us about it? I mean, Grounds for Dreaming, there's a wonderful subtitle that gets very detailed, but
yeah.
That brought so many different metaphors to my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to stop and let you explain how you came to decide on that. As
I'm
a title.
So glad you asked me that question because it's a really funny story. So this title took forever to come up with. Forever. Like, my dissertation was called Fields of Division, and then it went through all of these different other kind of working titles. And then when I got a book contract, I had changed the title to Unharvested Dreams, and it still had the same subtitle. But then I was on the bus one day with one of my colleagues, and he said, "That sounds like a book about IVF, in vitro fertilization." He's like, "I don't know about that." And I was like, "Okay, well, you just ruined the whole thing for me." So I had to like scrap Unharvested Dreams and come up with a less scientific sounding title. So I was asking everybody on Facebook, over email, "What do you think I should call this book?" And it just kind of came to me while I was on the phone with my sister and we were brainstorming and we were trying to think of maybe songs we knew that had lyrics in it that had to do with agriculture.
Mm-hmm.
There was like this Bruce Springsteen song that she was like thinking of. I was trying to think of other things. And then we just started talking about like earth, soil,
right.
ground.
Right.
Like, but we needed a title that sort of captured this simultaneous darkness and optimism. And so I wanted to keep the word dreaming in there because I didn't want this story to kind of end on this note of,
right.
you know, this is it and there's nothing we can do about, you know, farm worker struggle for rights. I didn't want it to be this story that was coming to some sort of end.
Right.
So with the dreaming part, it's like we've got the agricultural language in there, and we have this kind of image of people whose, you know, dreams do not have to be over. If, you mm-hmm. know, the struggle for farm worker rights and justice continues, I think there is a chance we could do right by the people who harvest our food every day and give them more of the protections they deserve. So that's a long answer to how the title came about. But I went through so many years of trying to figure out a title I was happy with, and I'm really happy with the way it came out.
Yeah, no, it's grabbing, I think, in a way that it's particularly when you start to read the book, it does what a wonderful title does, is it encapsulates an argument, but that does exactly what you were saying. There is no sort of, you know, declension in this type of narrative. It's you're not left with a kind of like a sad decline of a type of a movement or a hopelessness in, you know, the farm worker conditions now. It is very nuanced, the narrative is, but it does for me make connections to not only this movement, but also the dreaming part. I mean, for them, for these farm workers, what it is that they were thinking was possible, right, when they were organizing, when they're participating. And then also, it seems to me to even connect to later movements. I mean, it made me think now, although I know it's not necessarily part of the book, I mean, the dreamers now and just the continued right. struggle of Latino justice in various elements that continues to exist. So, wonderful title.
Oh, thank you. And the image is also great, too. I think this
yes,
cover image of people with their backs to the camera kind of looking out into the horizon,
mm-hmm.
standing on, you know, the bare earth. And you can't really tell if it's sunrise or sunset,
right.
but they're kind of looking into the distance. It's got this poetic feel to it and this kind of ethos of hopefulness that I think can come through.
Certainly. Well, the book is on the Salinas Valley, and I wanted you mentioned this in the introduction. I thought it was a great way to open the book. You talk about the Salinas Valley's most famous native son, John Steinbeck, and how in ways his wonderful work has maybe for most people that hear the Salinas Valley, it's established a certain narrative for them and brings certain images to their mind. And that's great for the stories that he tells, but how has that in ways limited the more nuanced and deeper history of the region?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want people to think I'm hating on Steinbeck.
No, not at all.
I just think I do, you know, I build upon Steinbeck. I think the view that people have of the Salinas Valley based on his novels and his writings, I think what he does communicate is that this place is populated by a very colorful array of characters, people, events. This is a dramatic place. It's a place to pay attention to in terms of social relationships, race relations, economic, you know, shifts and transformations. And what I wanted to do was sort of complicate the Latino community, because Steinbeck doesn't often really complicate his characters, Spanish-speaking characters, all that much. But it gives us a base from which to be familiar with the region. You imagine, like, these lush vegetable fields. You imagine this kind of thriving agricultural economy and the Salinas Valley becoming this giant in agribusiness by the mid-20th century. And so I want to use that to draw people in, to get people imagining that kind of backdrop, and then adding another layer onto it, which is, what if we shifted the narrative of this place, this narrative of this agricultural empire, to be a narrative that centers on Latinos, that centers on the farm workers upon which this region's wealth was built, you know, for so many decades. And if we flip the script in that way, the story of the Salinas Valley, it doesn't get any less colorful. It doesn't get any less interesting. It gets just more complicated. It might be darker. There might be darker truths there about racism and violence and conflict. But at the same time, you're doing justice to a community that may have been given short shrift in these public narratives about this region.
Right. Right. Well, and about the, you know, the very nuanced and, you know, even colorful demographics, if you will, of this region. I want to begin with your second chapter, because I think you do a great job of painting that picture. You describe the Salinas and the Salinas Valley as a place of racial meeting grounds and battlegrounds for this very multi-ethnic population that inhabited the region during the 1940s, which is where this chapter is situated. So what was it about certain spaces and social relations within the Salinas Valley that made them one or the other or both? You know, you bring an example in or two. So can you talk about that?
Yeah. So first of all, the Salinas Valley is one of the very first places that's importing Mexican guest workers by the trainload. So it's 1942. We're entering, you know, the Second World War. The U.S. government is looking to fill this labor void by agreeing in this binational labor agreement to import braceros, Mexican guest workers, from Mexico to work on U.S. railroads and in U.S. fields in agriculture. So along with places like Stockton or Oxnard, Salinas and the Salinas Valley become this kind of destination for braceros to begin infiltrating the labor market as these agricultural workers. So that is one thing that's happening in the World War II years. Another thing that is happening is that the Salinas Valley is really near the military installation of Fort Ord along the coast, like the Monterey Seaside area. So with that confluence of migrant workers coming in to work in the fields and soldiers sort of being around the area, whether they're on furlough or they're just, you know, at the base and coming into Salinas, you know, the Chinatown district on weekends to see a movie or to eat at a restaurant or go to a nightclub. You've got, you know, those two populations of people mixing with locals. And then at the same time, you've got these Tejano migrants coming from Texas and adding to the diversity of the region. And so the World War II years, which I cover in Chapter 2, are this time where all of these people are meeting together. They're meeting in public spaces like church or, you know, taxi stands or, you know, dance clubs. They're meeting in the workplace, out in the fields, but also in, you know, packing houses or other jobs that they're having. And then soldiers coming into contact with locals during wartime. So this is where we get a lot of things happening, like the Salinas Valley's version of the Zoot Suit Riots. Mm-hmm. They explode after the Zoot Suit Riots in L.A. because, you know, the Zoot Suit is catching on as a fashion, not just in cities like L.A. or Detroit or Harlem, you know, in Manhattan, but they're also taking hold and taking root in agricultural communities, too. So I talk a lot about Zoot Suiting and the conflicts between Zoot Suiters, soldiers, local residents, braceros. And then I talk about, you know, these meeting grounds, these moments of bonding that may happen between different people. So in unexpected ways, we get some sort of bonding happening, perhaps between Anglo-Americans who were Okies, who migrated as Okies in the 30s, coming into contact with Mexican-Americans or braceros and forming working relationships with them or social friendships with them. So in this era of the early 1940s, you see both people getting along with each other and people just totally not getting along with each other.
Right. And I appreciate in this chapter how you talk about these things like the you know, Salinas value, not value, the Salinas version of the Zoot Suit Riots, but it operated quite differently in Salinas, right? And it's particularly, you focus on, it is a very multi-ethnic place, and you bring a lot of these other, you know, non-Latino, if you will, non-Mexican, ethnic Mexican characters and people in, but the through line, the theme throughout the book is the interactions between the Mexican-Americans themselves, as well as braceros, and then eventually other forms of Mexican immigrants, whether undocumented immigrants, which would come on later. And so the conflict and both the elements of tension and cooperation that tend to go throughout the book is about this particularly, this triad, as you refer to them, right?
Yes, this kind of triangulated relationship between these three groups of Mexicans. Yeah, the Mexican-Americans, braceros, and undocumented migrants who start coming in larger numbers in the late 40s. And it's these relationships that I think are really complex. They kind of put twists on what we think we know about Latino history and Latino life in California. And so going back to the Zoot Suit thing, for instance, so many of us may kind of take as the common narrative that Zoot Suiters, especially in places like LA, were the ones at the bottom of the social hierarchy.
Right.
That they were suffering a lot of violence and brutality at the hands of the LAPD or naval servicemen and suffering a lot of violence. But interestingly enough, in places like Salinas, where you've got braceros, Zoot Suiters saw themselves as superior to braceros and treated them with violence and robbed them and attacked them and targeted them because of this notion that they may have, you know, seen them as inferior to them socioeconomically, citizenship-wise, and perhaps even in terms of masculinity. Mm-hmm. And so I think that puts a very different twist on what we think we know. And that's just one example of the types of inter-ethnic relationships that I talk about and how they may change what we think of Mexican-American politicization if we look at the agricultural context.
Exactly, exactly. And in moving on to the wetback era, which is covered in Chapter 3, tensions among Mexican-Americans and braceros, a lot of this was, you know, came out of the competition for similar, you know, labor space, right? But in this time, the 1950s, that is, particularly after World War II, this third group comes in. You talk a little bit later, and we'll talk about that, about the struggles extending and terminating the bracero program. But early on, even undocumented immigrants start to be another population. So will you explain for us and discuss the fields of division, the division that existed between these three different groups at this time, between the Mexican-Americans, the braceros, and the undocumented immigrants?
Yeah, well, like you already said, labor competition is a big thing here. So Mexican-Americans are threatened by both the braceros and undocumented migrants because they are being displaced by them. So employers are definitely preferring braceros because they're cheaper. Mm-hmm. They're working for less. They are prohibited in their labor contracts from unionizing. So now employers have a way to pull upon this workforce that is not going to rebel against them or that they, you know, see as more predictable, for instance, than Mexican Americans who could theoretically join a union, go out on strike at harvest time and disrupt their, you know, cultivation cycle. So that's one thing at play here. Another thing at play here is this is a time where the INS is ramping up its surveillance and its efforts at policing the U.S.-Mexico border. So even before we get, you know, the infamous Operation Wetback of 1954, in agricultural California, the INS is already instituting things like Operation Sacramento, Operation Salinas, Operation Stockton, all of these different little operations in which they're doing what Operation Wetback would do later, in that these are, you know, big dragnets which are trying to deport people, apprehending them in public spaces, at work, on the street, in movie theaters, in churches. You know, these INS authorities are already recognizing that the Salinas Valley and other agricultural hubs in California are sort of these wet spaces. It's like these spaces in which employers are complicit in the, quote, wetback problem. And it's that presence of the INS, because the INS sets up branches all over agricultural California, and then Mexican-Americans start getting very, even, you know, more resentful, because not only are they having to compete with braceros and undocumented migrants, now they're being assumed to be undocumented themselves because of this racial conflation that's going on by the INS and by white Americans, thinking, oh, well, you know, your last name or how you look or the Spanish you're speaking makes me think you don't belong here. So Mexican Americans who up to this point had been fighting so hard for social inclusion and respectability feel like it's all going to be destroyed by these new competitors in the labor market.
Right. And you, there's a couple things that you bring up in this chapter. There's a great phrase you have in here that really, I think, encapsulates what the presence of undocumented immigrants came to signify at this point. You have in here that identities had become commodities around this time when these raids are being conducted, and you already had the presence and intentions of braceros, but how did the presence of the undocumented immigrants kick that up a notch, if you will, to where this real this identification as a Mexican American, or even we're having this triad of a, you know, or a bracero, which had a sense of, you know, legality to it too, and being having a contract that you were tied to. How did that just kick up this what will we encapsulate within this phrase, where the importance of identity?
Yeah, identity is, that's what I found most fascinating in researching for my chapters on the 50s. It was this time where, because the INS, you know, La Migra was becoming such a big threat and presence in the lives of Latinos, we get undocumented migrants purchasing these false documents of identity. So pretending to be someone you're not, pretending to be a U.S. citizen, acquiring birth certificates or driver's licenses, photographs of yourself in the United States, doctoring certain documents. All of this stuff is going on so very much that people are buying identities, they're trading them, they're selling them, they're switching them. And Mexican Americans certainly find this upsetting. And in fact, we see cases in which Mexican Americans are calling in to the INS about undocumented migrants that they know about in their communities, because it had gotten to the point where they were frustrated. They were frustrated by the fact that the INS was stopping them and assuming they were undocumented. And so I argue that one of the ways in which they sought to present themselves as respectable Americans was to turn in those who they felt were breaking the law. And then on the other hand of the equation, braceros, you know, have this legal contracted identity. They are supposed to be there. They have a, you know, a reason for being there. But if they're with an employer who they really do not want to be working for anymore, if they want to get out of their situation, we get a lot of people skipping out on right. their labor contracts, and they're called skips.
Right.
So in looking through governmental documents, I found that in the Salinas Valley, more braceros skipped in the Salinas Valley than in any other part of California.
Wow.
Even the Imperial Valley, which employed so many more thousands of braceros, it was the Salinas Valley where we see the highest number of skips, almost up to 20% of braceros were just leaving because they just did not want to work for those employers anymore. It was too harsh conditions for too little pay. And it's interesting because then braceros adopt this illegal identity by skipping out on their contracts. Now they are joining the ranks of the right. undocumented and embracing that, quote, illegal identity. And for the U.S. government, that's highly embarrassing. Like, if you have a bracero program that's supposed to be the legal solution to the wetback problem.
Exactly.
And then you get those braceros being, you know, like, to hell with this. I'm going to be undocumented because it's a preferable identity for me. That kind of tears down the rationale for having a bracero program because it's not helping anything. It's only adding to the undocumented immigration, you know, flow. So that's why the INS is trying to be so hypervigilant, and that's why the U.S. government is funneling so many resources into immigration-related surveillance and deportation, because they want the bracero program to look good
right.
in comparison, and they want to continue it for many years after that.
in a way, that's what's contributing to this issue of the growing undocumented population. We haven't even gotten to near the end of the program yet, but is this insatiable demand and desire? I mean, just almost a drunkenness, if you will, of the growers on Mexican labor.
Yeah.
Can you speak to a bit, at least within this era, before the termination of the Bracero program, how the, you know, this wetback problem emerges, and as part of it's skipping, and can bring in some of the other issues that are causing a growth in this population, despite the fact that we have a contract labor agreement with Mexico that's supposed to prevent this.
Right, right. Yes. You know, looking at smuggling records and the ways in which people were coming to think of the Salinas Valley as a destination where you could get away with blending in and that you could find work if you were sin papeles, without papers. That is why we get so much undocumented immigration coming to the Salinas Valley, because of networks of communication and smuggler networks, people who are agreeing to take people from Tijuana or Calexico or, you know, up to the salad bowl of the world, because they know they'll find work. They know there's tons of braceros there. They can pass for someone working out in the fields with a contract. And sometimes the INS would regularize you as a bracero anyway. They would not make you go back to Mexico. Sometimes they would just give you to an employer. So this undocumented immigration is creating all sorts of, you know, tensions between different groups of Mexicans themselves, but also, like you said, getting growers and getting agribusiness used to always having this bottomless well of Mexican labor. And, you know, the memos that they're writing to the INS sometimes are, can you guys lay off on the deportation rates because we need to harvest our tomatoes, you know? It's this kind of unbelievable entitlement.
That's the exact word I was thinking. This sense of, such a strong sense of entitlement that they were entitled to this form of labor, to Mexican labor.
Yes.
You know, that was shocking to me.
Yeah, they did not want to let it go. They got used to that pattern, and they really, really did not want the Bracero program to end, and were some of the most virulent lobbyists for continuing the program, to getting Congress to continue the program.
Right. We've been talking a bit about the effect of the Bracero program on the dynamics between Mexican-American and Bracero social and working relationships. Let's talk more about politics, and that's a lot of what's at the meat of this book, and that's, you know, what I love about it. It's right at my heart. So in Chapter 4, you switch to a discussion of the Salinas chapter of the Community Service Organization, and eventually how the division between Mexican Americans and agricultural, you know, working Mexican Americans also. So you kind of, there's a division within the Mexican American community, emerges because of, you know, it's in an agricultural space. The CSO is, you know, born out of a urban space, came out of LA, had a number of chapters in LA, at least two, I believe, before they start extending up to San Jose and then to agricultural spaces with up and down California. So can you talk more about that, about this, the distinctiveness of agricultural place with this attempt to build a Mexican-American civil rights type of organization and movement in the Valley?
Yeah, we know a lot about the CSO when it comes to LA, right? When it comes to urban settings and what tremendous things that organization accomplished over time. We know less about the CSO in agricultural spaces. Steve Pitty in The Devil in Silicon Valley talks about that a bit in talking about Santa Clara, the San Jose area. But the CSO in the Salinas Valley, or rather they called themselves the Monterey County CSO to kind of encompass a lot more towns in that region. What's interesting about it is that eventually the CSO, you know, first of all, it's founded because there is this murder that takes place between two groups of high school students, one white, one Mexican American. And a teenager, a white teenager, ends up being stabbed in this gang fight, and a Mexican-American teenager with a farm worker background is accused of being the murderer. And the CSO was an outgrowth of the group of people who were friends and neighbors who tried to get that accused teenager, you know, visitation rights from his parents in jail, get him a proper defense lawyer. The CSO grows out of that very local case of people wanting to defend one of their own.
Mm-hmm.
Over time, the CSO in the Salinas Valley, it splits into these two groups. You've got, I don't want to say middle class, but you've got sort of, you know, upper working class, you know, people who are a little bit more stable in their jobs, who are, you know, occupations like court reporters, or maybe they're supervisors of braceros. They are up a little bit in that agricultural ladder. And then you've got CSO members who are very close to the world of agriculture. They're lower working class, the working poor, basically. They have a lot more contact with farm workers. They know what farm workers are going through. And so over time, we get two different CSOs in Monterey County. We get the CSO in Salinas, which tends to be made up of people who want to, you know, reach their hand out to the mayor, to the city council, to get that respectability that they want, especially in the 50s where they want to prove that they're good Americans in the Cold War. And then we've got that other, you know, contingent that is in the town of Soledad, and they are, you know, more of the type to say, hey, we need more stoplights. We need more municipal attention to our neighborhoods. You, that school principal needs to apologize to that kid for, you know, punishing him for speaking Spanish. They are being a little bit more militant because they feel they have very little to lose. They want to be more radical, and they start to fight with these more respectability-seeking CSO members. And so eventually the CSO in Monterey County falls apart because there's just so much tension between, you know, what Fred Ross called the more cream puff operation of the CSO, of trying to get that respectability from city officials and authorities, and that more direct action-focused, maybe more radical politics of the other side. So it's interesting how the CSO story plays out in that context.
I completely agree. I think it was a really interesting case study to see, to examine the issues that an ethnic population deals with in a, you know, in with an organization that, again, comes out of an urban setting, but that's in an agriculture, so gets transported to an agricultural setting. So I guess what I'm getting at here is a organization that's trying to deal with a population that's not just, you know, either urban or agricultural, you know, and that's one of the issues with that you see with Mexico, throughout Mexican-American or Latino history, is how do you organize not just such a diverse ethnic, intra-ethnic population, but one that has different divisions of class, even though, as you're explaining, some CSOers have become a little more, if you will, like of an ethnic middle class. They certainly weren't anywhere near like the white middle class, right? But in most instances, but then there was a good base of them, right, that were in this other category, the working poor, and that the CSO, at least in this area, eventually just, they couldn't figure out how to deal with the bracero issue, right? They couldn't figure out how to deal with the farm worker issue, right? And that eventually pulls them apart.
Yeah.
And even there's a quote that you have in the book of where I think even Chavez is reflecting that initially when they were, I can't remember if it was when they were organizing this chapter, when he's doing the early CSO organizing work part of his career, that even he didn't comprehend at the time just how intricate and how problematic the bracero problem was to try to handle and tackle.
Yes, yeah. That was during the time he was trying to organize in Ventura County, and braceros kept on coming to him with their problems, and Chavez felt he had enough on his plate just trying to get U.S. citizen farm workers to stop getting fired because of this importation of braceros, and so it was this tension between, you know, trying to get people back into their farm labor jobs versus correcting the conditions in farm labor jobs.
Right.
And that threw a whole wrench into his plan. And I think that's what got him interested in making that a whole separate issue of resigning from the CSO and concentrating solely on the conditions of farm workers.
Mm-hmm. So the Bracero program had been pretty divisive amongst ethnic Mexicans, and particularly within their politics, and up to this point, and that pretty much stays until a very significant and tragic accident that happens in, I'm going to let you pronounce it because I've...
Chualar,
okay. In Chualar in 1963. Will you talk about this accident and how that changed, if you will, or shifted how the ethnic Mexican political community at least began to mobilize and perhaps even be a little bit more cohesive afterwards?
So this is what I think is a climactic chapter of the book. It's, you know, mid-September 1963, there's a busload of braceros going back home to their labor camp after working in the fields, a really long day harvesting celery and other vegetables. And they're being driven by their foreman, who's, you know, sitting with the other supervisor who's checking the timesheets in the front, you know, passenger compartment of this labor bus. And this bus, you know, I'll put it in quotes because it was just really a converted, you know, pickup truck, basically. I mean, there was like a big, you know, back compartment with this makeshift canopy put on top. There were two long wooden benches inside, but no seatbelts, no kind of protective mechanisms for keeping people in place. And what they did was cram, you know, over 30 people into the back of this vehicle and start driving home. So they come to an unmarked railroad crossing in the town of Chualar, which is close to the town of Salinas. And the driver hears a whistle in, you know, the background, but doesn't see a train. And so he starts inching the wheels of the bus over the train tracks. And then that sound of the whistle gets louder and he panics and he still doesn't see a train, but he sort of guns the motor to get the labor bus across. But he was too late. You know, this freight train, which ironically is carrying a load of sugar beets, you know, just comes and shears that bracero vehicle in half. So bodies go flying, work tools go flying. Some people are thrown hundreds of feet beyond the point of impact. I mean, it's a horrific accident.
It is. You know, I had to, there are parts I had to just kind of start skipping a few lines.
I know. It's graphic.
It was very graphic. I mean, your detail of it is incredible. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, I could see it.
Yeah.
It's painful to read.
It's painful. And I had somebody tell me she was, you know, crying on an airplane while reading, you know, that section. It's a very graphic, horrific accident. And to date was the most fatal bracero accident in California, the most fatal vehicle accident in California history up until that point. And I think what this crash did and the deaths of 31 braceros, plus one undocumented migrant who was discovered later to have been in that vehicle too. What these 32 deaths sort of showed people is, you know, this is happening way too much. It's killing way too many people. And for many Mexican-American civil rights activists out there, it was the last straw. Like, this had happened enough. It was happening not only in California, but in Florida, in Arkansas, in Pennsylvania, in Oregon. You know, all these different places that are using braceros, they are dying because of reckless transportation, very hazardous conditions. And so this coalition of Mexican-American activists who are both urban-based and rural-based come together to protest to the Kennedy administration, like, you've got to end this program.
Right.
And I think, you know, and this is what I argue in the chapter, is I think that that's the moment. Even before Chavez and his grape strike hit Delano in 1965, 2 years earlier, we start to see those urban-rural connections being forged out of this tragedy. It's so tragic. It's so infuriating to people who are like, see, like, this is not just a program that is hurting our citizen farm workers who are out of jobs. It's killing these, you know, imported laborers from across the border who we should be treating as much more than just tools thrown in the back of a truck.
Right. Well, and in particular for the Mexican Americanist, you know, organizations, it galvanizes about pretty much been about half a dozen or so that had pretty much had a lot of infighting before,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And if you want, couldn't figure out a way to essentially, they certain moments brought them together, but this really became a moment that began to galvanize them in a unified voice of opposition. And so we have so in part due to this tragedy, the Bracero program is allowed to officially that is, right, expire
officially.
At the end of December in 1964. yet. As you explain, Mexican and Japanese and Filipino contract labor extensions continue to happen. So this doesn't go away.
Mm-hmm.
In the next chapter, you continue by talking about how the Salinas Valley laid an important groundwork for the farm worker movement, right, in the valley. This incident itself and this kind of galvanizing of the Mexican Americanist activist community was part of that. Were some other things that happened in Salinas to prepare the soil, if you will, mm-hmm. for the Chavistas that would come in, who get a lot of the attention, but again, when we focus on these big flashpoints, a lot of times we forget the underlying complexity and nuance to what's at the table, if you will.
Yes, and I'm so glad you saw that, because we do tend to forget, you know, the years leading up to Chavez's national stardom, if you will, as this new Mexican-American civil and labor rights leader. What made him so successful? What prepared that ground for him to have a receptive audience when he came to organize lettuce workers in Salinas in 1970? And I think it is in large part what farm workers are doing in terms of their own activism in the early to mid 1960s, and then later in the decade when they're waiting for Chavez to, you know, get his grape strike off the ground and win. So what they're doing, what farm workers are doing at this time, is using legal aid organizations to sue their employers and to file important lawsuits against agribusiness. And the main legal aid organization they go to in the Salinas Valley is CRLA, which is the California Rural Legal Assistance Organization, which gets funded under the War on Poverty. It's this organization that is meant to be a place where farm workers go with their grievances and go to court to rectify conditions, wages, treatment. And this alliance with CRLA is a big reason why Chavez's job organizing workers in Salinas was made vastly easier, because one big lawsuit that 9 Salinas farm workers participate in is this lawsuit that results in California farm workers being allowed for the first time to have the legal right to collectively bargain with their employers. Now there's a law saying you are protected in your right to unionize, and you can't be threatened with firing if you join a union. So this longtime practice that employers were using, this longtime intimidation of their workers to sort of be like, if you join a union, you're out of a job. They can't do that anymore, right, legally at least.
Mm-hmm.
And so Chavez's job becomes vastly easier, because now he doesn't need to persuade people one by one, you know, and beg them to join a union. Now people know that they can join a union, and that makes them much more receptive to the UFW when it comes to the region in 1970.
Right, and there was also a second case, right, another one that actually put a stop to the continued importation of Mexican and other, you know, guest workers.
Yes.
Quasi extensions, etc., of the Bracero program, even though it was about to expire. But
oh yeah, there were so many extensions. Yeah, the Bracero program on paper was supposed mm-hmm. to end in 1964, but California growers were so stubborn. They kept right. on asking for more and more imported workers, to the point where they eventually wore down the Secretary of Labor, who started right. giving them the workers. So it's like that.
Well, first was really
bending.
Opposition in opposition to them, right? I forget
right.
his name. Was his name Wirtz? Right.
Willard Wirtz,
right? So initially mm-hmm. he was very adamant to shut
yes.
the program down and ignore the growers, but they were so persistent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's almost as if there's some way there was like a grower constitution that said they had a right to Mexican labor or something. I mean, that's how their language, as you explain it, was in their letters and in their petitions and in their lobbying. It was, you know, how could you even think to try to stop this.
Right, like how can
you
deprive us of this labor that we need? It was this constant refrain of, we need these workers. We need them because we don't have enough domestic workers, which, by the way, was a lie. Like, they mm-hmm. had a ton of domestic workers that they could use, domestic meaning U.S. citizen
mm-hmm.
workers.
Right.
They just didn't want to pay them
right.
what U.S. citizen farm
exactly.
workers wanted to be paid. So Wirtz, who was a labor law professor before he became the Secretary of Labor, yeah, at first said, the Bracero era is over. like, don't even think about it. It's, you know, you're not going to get any more out of us.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then he finally bends to all their requests. And, you know, it's, that's what allows Bracero importation to continue in California until 1968.
Wow.
When Salinas farm workers file a lawsuit that gets the Department of Labor and the INS to stop this importation of pseudo braceros, these pseudo imported guest workers that shouldn't be there anymore.
Right. Well, that brings us up to the 1970 Salinas strike with the UFWOC. Will you discuss the differences between the UFWOC mobilizations in Salinas versus, you know, perhaps the next, you know, most popular and well-known destination or site, which is Delano,
yeah.
And the differences so between those mobilizations and eventually the strike and how those came together?
Labor historians, I think, have focused much more on Delano than Salinas. Delano, you know, for good reason. I mean, Delano is this first big grape strike and boycott that sweeps the nation and results in big victory. Like, it takes 5 years, but in 1970, the United Farm Workers Organizing Committee signs contracts with some of the largest grape growers in the world. And this idea of reaching out to the American public and American consumers and asking them to join farm workers in boycotting non-union grapes, it's such a brilliant technique. It's such a brilliant strategy that, of course, Delano being this first example of it, more scholars pay attention to it. But
right.
I think what happens after, you know, the lettuce boycott and the lettuce strikes that go on in Salinas in 1970, they are just as important to look at, because that strike was, you know, full of racialized violence. It was full of this kind of, you know, never before seen cooperation between Mexican Americans and Mexican nationals. It was a strike that witnessed the incredible participation of women.
Right.
It's just a really, really important strike to pay attention to. And in Salinas, the whole way that lettuce work is structured makes it a different place. So unlike grape workers, for instance, vineyard workers, who may not be organized into labor crews when they get hired,
right,
lettuce workers do organize themselves into work crews before they ever get hired.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so those are little proto-unions.
Right.
They are like
mm-hmm.
these groups of relatives or friends or people who are working together in the migrant circuit. They are already acting as a unit even before they start getting hired in the fields. So when one person in that group thinks joining the union is a good idea, the rest of that group follows. And that's automatically many more people signing union membership cards than going individual by individual and getting people to
right.
join. So the very structure of lettuce, it's ironic because the very monoculture that these Salinas Valley agriculturalists think is getting them the most profit is actually what's turning their workers against them.
Mm-hmm.
Because that monoculture of lettuce allows these workers in work crews to act as units and to be more ready to strike. And that's what makes the Salinas strike of 1970 different, is that there was this electricity, there was this readiness to join the United Farm Workers that we don't see in Delano. They were just more eager to get something going.
Right, and it seemed from your the book, it surprised, right, Dolores Huerta and Chavez and the organizers that went into the valley, and they had to essentially calm, if you will, the lettuce workers down to keep them from striking when
yeah.
they wanted to. I mean, they were like, yeah, let's do this now.
Right. Yeah. No, I know. The UFW organizers like Dolores Huerta, Marshall Gans, all of these people there, they had to stand up on chairs at union meetings and be like, okay, like, we know we're going to strike, but you got to be patient. Like, we can't do it right now. We've got to, you mm-hmm. know, plan the right time. But these workers were ready to go. Some of them were highly class conscious already. Some of them had been unionists in Mexico before they ever came to the United States. So they really, really had to harness the energy and this eagerness to walk out of their jobs. It was quite different, and I think surprised the union.
And again, on this concept of the end of the Bracero program being a kind of galvanizing moment for the ethnic Mexican activists, both, you know, in the fields and outside of it. There's a moment in the book where you describe this, where Chavez comes to, right, the first, I guess, meeting, collective meeting that's set in Salinas. It's in this gymnasium.
Yeah.
Right. And can you talk a bit of the you know, what is it? The, not just the organizational demographics that were in there. It wasn't just full of farm workers, right?
Right. Right. Yeah. The people who showed up to Chavez's rallies and who showed up to those first meetings, you had such a wide array of people there. You had Mexican American farm workers. You had ex-braceros who were interested in this movement. You had undocumented migrants. You had Tejano migrants. You had Anglo-American, African-American, Filipino-American farm workers, and also just local community members. You had all the media there, all the local media, and you had the Mexican-American middle class, the people who may not have been the ones out on the picket lines, but the ones who may have been, you know, working in their own ways to foster this kind of Chicano movement rhetoric, this, you know, language of ethnic pride, this language of, you know, maybe we can finally turn what has been a nightmare in terms of how Latinos have been treated in this region into this great dream that we've been having about gaining some more socioeconomic equality and respect.
Right. You say that, I think you're right, that it's at this moment around this, the timing of this, this type of meeting and these mobilizations, that the term La Raza starts to be used across, you know, say, political generations, if
yeah.
you will, where there's, there really seems to be a sense of collective community, both social and political, that is emerging.
Yeah. Now, this is the time where we start seeing Mecha crop up in Salinas high schools and colleges. We see people engaging in Chicano protests. The students at Hartnell College start asking for more Mexican-American curriculum and more Mexican-American teachers in their schools. We get parents advocating for free lunch programs. Like, the Chicano movement wasn't just a farm worker movement.
Right.
It was so much bigger than that, and I think the Salinas Valley really fed upon all of that combined energy. And you also had these student volunteers coming from the Deep South, you know, right out of Freedom Summer or these right. other mm-hmm. African-American civil rights focused movements, and volunteering their time to the farm workers. So you had this very excited group of people who transcended class lines, racial lines, gender lines, age lines. It was incredible, the mass of people who were there in support of the union.
Right. You make this argument that it, this is the, this is perhaps the first moment, right, when you see a merger of urban and agricultural issues within this emerging Chicano movement, at least in California.
At least in California, yeah. I think there might be a very different story in places like Texas or New mm-hmm. Mexico or other places in the Southwest, but at least in California, you know, I, it's not only that bracero accident I was talking about beforehand, but it's you know, this farm worker justice struggle that I think brings those urban Chicanos in from places like LA and have them add to the energy of, you know, that agricultural working class mm-hmm. who they may have been very disconnected from at first, right. but now are intimately connected with.
Right. Well, the conclusion moves on to a discussion of the farmer worker movement in the late 20th century. Can you talk a bit about that and, you know, bring us up to almost to date, if you will?
Yeah, the epilogue of the book tries to bring us up to date. Officially, the book ends with the, you know, that story of the 1970s strike and the victories that workers were able to secure in those moments, but sadly, there is still a long way to go when it comes to offering farm workers the rights and protections that they need out in the field. So over time, farm worker wages have decreased considerably if we take into account cost of living and what unionized farm workers might have been making in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
The equivalent today just comes nowhere close to that. So farm workers are still not making enough. They're not making a living wage, that's for sure. And they're still working, you know, backbreaking hours, 10 to 14 hours a day. Some, you know, places offer no day of rest. So, for instance, I live in New York. In the Hudson Valley of New York, farm workers who work in apple orchards or who are, you know, taking care of geese for pate, you know, these workers don't get a day of rest. They are working 7 days
right.
a week, kind of trapped in those, on the land of their employer if they live in employer-provided housing. the H-2A temporary agricultural visa program we have in installed in our government now. It is very similar to the Bracero program in that we are contracting guest workers and tying them to one employer with no alternative if you do not like where you're working. So workers, farm workers, are still now very intimidated to stand up and say anything against their conditions because they're so afraid that they'll be deported, that they'll be terminated, that they won't get to participate in a guest worker program ever again. And so it's that silencing of farm workers and guest workers that is very concerning to me. And, you know, things like pesticides are still a problem. Mm-hmm. Sexual assault and rape, you know, of female farm workers is a problem. You know, the lack of health care and the hazardous transporting conditions of farm workers is still a problem. So that horrific accident in 1963, we're still seeing accidents like that. There was just an accident a few months ago like that, where, you know, several H-2A guest workers were killed. And so, sadly, history is echoing, and we're seeing it very much in the present day. And agribusiness is still evading a lot of regulation that we have perhaps instituted in the industrial sector, but have really not instituted in the agricultural sector.
Yes, it is. It is shocking in ways that this book is a work of history. Yet, as you read it, you can't help but see all the contemporary parallels. And you know, it's probably the phrase you just used, echoes. It really does seem, in ways that conditions in so many instances, although not identical, are very similar. You mentioned the continued guest worker, you know, visa programs that exist yet don't come anywhere near where they need to in establishing the type of protections and wages that actually acknowledge these people as humans and contributing to greatly to our society and our own levels of comfort, but also that don't come anywhere near to meeting the need of the labor that agribusiness continues to desire. Not now, it's just not agribusiness, of course, it's service, various service sectors and industrial sectors, to where undocumented migration can, although it's been at a net zero for quite
a
while.
That's true.
But it still continues to exist. All these dynamics are still at play.
Yes.
At least is what we're saying. Right?
And all these debates around, you know, controlling our borders, how we treat the immigrants in our borders, these are the same debates we've been having for decades.
Right.
And in the conclusion, I think I sort of show readers that I don't consider myself just a, you know, a dispassionate observer of all of these things going on. I'm very passionate in what I feel we should be caring about. And so the epilogue is kind of this call to be more aware of the world we're living in today and how if we just pay attention to history, we may realize that the kinds of questions and the kinds of debates we're seeing in the political realm, these have been questions and debates we've seen before. And if we don't do something different, we're never going to give this very vulnerable population of workers the protections they deserve. And of all, you know, the different working populations in our nation, farm workers are some of the most invisible, unheard people. And if anything, we need to be paying greater attention to the ways in which we treat them.
Exactly. And that is indeed the call that seems to come across in the closing pages of the book, where you really state emphatically that the work collectively is sought to help us understand the importance of Mexican, Mexican-Americans and ethnic Mexicans in agricultural communities in, you know, our lives and our nation's history, whether it be politics, whether it be, you know, our broader society and as the issues that we're talking about, just in the, you know, this the very base level of what ends up on your table. You know, the lives of these people and their work has throughout history now for a very deep history, a very, you know, at least, you know, we're talking, this is rather recent, but you can go back a century and even more to see how, you know, there these populations have continued to influence the direction of our society.
Yeah, and if anything,
thereby their importance.
Yeah, if anything, as scholars of Latino history or Latino studies, what we're trying to do is make clear that Latino history is American history.
Exactly. Right.
That no matter if you're studying World War II or the Cold War or the New Deal or Reaganomics, I mean, you mm-hmm. have to consider that Latinos have always been a part of the greater national narrative. And it's just that, you know, more people need to pay attention to the ways in which we can see the Latino condition as emblematic of significant transitions in our nation's history and significant moments. It's all about shifting the lens. And,
yes.
mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, really grateful that I had so much support along my journey in completing this book. It was, you know, people believing that this story was important that allowed me to finally tell it.
Well, it's been wonderful talking about this book. I wanted to give you a moment to, although I know you're just catching your breath, having this thing come off the presses and even, you know, touring around and presenting it, and appreciate you coming again on our channel to discuss it. Can you tell us a little bit on maybe what's coming up next?
Yeah, well, my answer to this question won't be as fully developed as perhaps some people would want. I am still celebrating this book, and
course,
I think we should give each other time to celebrate our books, especially our first books. I mean, it's just mm-hmm. such a big deal for junior scholars. And but I am thinking about possibilities when it comes to a project centered in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. So that is a historiography that needs to be built up for sure. And it will stretch me as somebody who's just focused on the Mexican origin experience.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Teaching at Stony Brook, I'm teaching students of all different sorts of Latino backgrounds.
Certainly.
And mm-hmm. I think I want to challenge myself to speak about this intersectionality. Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, Salvadorans, other Central Americans and Caribbean populations. How are these different groups of Latinos interacting with each other in the Northeast? How can we start to construct a comprehensive history of the Latino Northeast? Is it, you know, how can we start doing that? And how can I build upon the great scholarship that has been produced on places like New York,
right.
And keep adding to it? So I'm thinking about that for now, but we will see. We'll see.
We'll leave it there. That sounds great. Thanks again for your time, Lori. And we've really, really enjoyed having you on, and loved reading the book. Appreciate
it. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me on the channel. I'm really grateful. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation today with Lori Flores, author of Grounds for Dreaming, Mexican Americans, Mexican Immigrants, and the California Farmworker Movement, published by Yale University Press in 2015. I encourage you to grab a copy of Dr. Flores' book, and you may do so by following the link to Amazon on our New Books in Latino Studies page. You may also reach me by emailing newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com or reaching out through Facebook and Twitter. You may also comment on this podcast through iTunes.